Let's talk.
John Brown. Football, and in wind and rain, the making of the British game. It provides an educational but entertaining bite-sized accounts of how the history of British football and its people developed from the beginnings of the game in the mid-19th century to the Leviathan, I think we can say that it is today. Delighted to be joined live on the line by the author of Football in Wind and Rain, John Williams. John, good morning to you.
Yeah, hi, nice to be here.
Pleasure's all mine. And it'd be a story about football. I suppose you're somewhere in a gratis sort of penthouse in Dubai or Saudi Arabia, overlooking you know, your private yacht, etc.
Sadly not, if only. I'm in Leicester, in gloomy Leicester, but surrounded by my books.
Well, yes, indeed. Yeah, and I'm very impressed as well. Now, your background is interesting because, obviously, you are an academic, a sociologist, who picks this particular sort of reflection of the British character and society because, as I always say, my listeners will be groaning, nothing exists in a vacuum. And if you're looking for a development of British society or a mirror of British society, then perhaps football has it all.
Yeah, I'm trying to do a number of things here. I'm trying to say to the general reader, don't be afraid of academics writing about popular topics like football. So this is not for academics. I've tried to make this a series of stories that I think people will enjoy. And this is not just about British football, actually, although that's what's on the front cover, because, like it or not, it was the British who took the modern game around the world. And so this is really about the moment when the modern game is invented, and then the great kind of torture that the British experienced about what to do with the rest of the world and how to connect the game with the rest of the world, and should they even be a part of the game playing against other countries. So for those people who think this is only about Britain, think again. This is also about South America, and it's also about Europe, and how connections eventually between the British and different parts of the world spread the game.
Well, I'm sitting in southern Spain, and if I was to head sort of west for a couple of hours, I'd bump into Huelva. And Huelva, of course, is where the British first introduced the game of football to Spain, or I might be completely wrong. But it was a thing of empire, wasn't it, as well? You know, the British Empire was spreading, and people tend to think about cricket in the empire, but actually football was, you know, association football was there as well.
Yeah, no, listen, absolutely. And it's one of the reasons why race, unfortunately, and racism is baked into the game right at the very beginning, because the British thought, the British upper classes, particularly the English public schools, thought that you could use sport, cricket and football, to civilize people from lesser cultures. And that's also one of the reasons why the British were hesitant about playing other countries, because they felt that other nations didn't understand fairness, and they didn't understand the core values of sport, and that they felt it was a risky business to get too close to people from other cultures. Best to let them have the game and develop it their own way. But the British kept out, really. It's extraordinary that the British didn't even play in the World Cup until 1950. Mm. For precisely these reasons. They feared politics. They feared nationalism in sport. They feared the values of the game wouldn't be understood by people from other countries. So it's a really kind of quite tortured relationship we had with people in other nations.
Is it that sort of the Corinthian ideal then? That, you know, the game, you know, again, different time, different sort of way, perspectives of looking at the world, to put it mildly. But this is the Victorian thing, and it's all about health and fitness and empire out there. Yeah,
and that was, and of course, there were great class tensions, because the people from the public schools who formed the Football Association in 1863. They felt the game should be played for its own sake. They forgot their own social and economic advantage, of course. They felt everyone should be able to play football like them. They really prized amateurism. They hated professionalism. And so when the game began to spread amongst working people, and they wanted to spread the game amongst working people, they were also afeared that working people would want to win too much. Mm. and the clubs in the North and the Midlands would recruit professional players or hide their professionalism, which indeed is exactly what happened. So right at the very beginning of the game, the FA Cup is dominated by public school types until in 1883, Blackburn Olympic win the FA Cup, and then the amateurs are gone. They're never going to win the FA Cup again, and the FA is going to have to deal with the problem of professionalism and eventually accept that some working-class men will want to be paid to play.
I'm just thinking about the, if you like, the physicality of the game. Bear with me on this one, John, if you would, because if you think about the other games that the English public school boys or the Empire takes with them, cricket, unless you've got a, you don't come into the close contact unless you've got a particularly sort of vociferous guy bowling at you at 90 miles an hour, but still he is far away from you, if you like. You've got your bat to defend yourself. Polo, well, you're never going to get a working class person playing polo. Rugby union is played, you have to understand the rules, etc. So that's between consenting adults, if you will. But football, if you've got somebody from a public school and they're playing a minor, for example, in terms of somebody who works down the pits, it gives the person from quote unquote a lower strata a good excuse to thump into somebody. And anyone comes into close contact with them that much?
Well, I think that's a real difficulty at the beginning. And certainly the people from the higher social classes who wanted to protect rugby because of its physicality, because, of course, don't forget that sport in the 19th century was about preparation for war. Mm. It was about regulation and discipline and leadership and all of those things, but it was also about making sure that people from higher social classes could bind solidly together and believe in each other on the battlefield. And, of course, there are lots of famous stories about footballs being kicked on the battlefield in the First World War as people rose from the trenches. So there is that physicality baked into the hackers game of rugby union. But some modernizers from the higher social classes also realized that so many people now lived in cities, you couldn't play rugby in the city. You had to play a more modern, a less physical. People couldn't afford to be injured in quite the way that rugby allowed injuries to occur. And so gradually there was a softening of the relationship between the higher social classes and the lower social classes. And that was managed through football much more than it was managed through rugby union, which remained pretty much a social elites game.
Mm. I'm talking about the social elites. I'm just wondering who the first sort of, because we talk about every sense of focus on what's happening on the pitch, but away from that, in the stands, who's what is the spectators like? Who are the fans, if you will? Because obviously this is to begin with, I suppose it's lots of sort of like Georgina's cheering, plucky chaps in hoops from the sidelines. But obviously that changes. And you mentioned Blackburn Olympic. Well, that is. This is the Northwest, the Northern dominance, the industrial heartland that then takes over the game, if you like, during that sort of 20th century. So how does the spectating public change, as it were?
Yeah, really interesting question. Initially, of course, it was public school types.
Yeah.
Because they turned out to see their fellow public school members win the FA Cup routinely in the Oval, in Kennington Oval in London. But gradually, as local merchants began to realize that having a football club in the Midlands or in the North could be a sign of great status, and you might be able to win the FA Cup, this national competition. Then they started to recruit professionals. Then they began to build modest stadiums, and then they brought in people to watch and pay, because you needed to pay these professionals. The FA didn't like this at all, of course, because they wanted working people to play sport, not to watch sports and get drunk and bet and gamble and so on and so forth. So, there's a little bit of evidence about who the working men were who watched early football, but also some accounts of the women who went to watch. Because very early on, women were allowed to go to watch free. And one of the reasons for that was because the authorities were concerned about the potential violence of men. If you had too many men together watching the game drunk, they may get very unhappy and turn on the referee or the players. So one way of trying to solve that problem was to say, look, bring your wives or bring your girlfriends along, and they can come in for free. And there's quite a lot of evidence in the late 19th century of women getting really quite involved in the game as spectators. The key thing, though, was they weren't allowed to play.
Mm.
Because if you allowed women to play, that would somehow demean men and demean the game itself, because the game is about testing masculinities. And so although women really, really tried hard and made strong representations to the powers that be that they should be allowed to play, and they organized some small tournaments, it was really, really difficult for them to get a strong hold in the game until the First World War, when things completely changed very briefly because men were off to war. Women now were regarded as patriotic if they wanted to play, because they were raising money for the war effort. And hey, presto, women found they could play. And they were actually pretty good. And the people wanted to watch them play. But as soon as men came back, the FA effectively banned them from playing in England for 50 years.
Yeah, I spoke with, I interviewed one of the daughters of, I think it was the 1970 Women's World Cup in Mexico when they...
1971.
Fantastic. I mean, but yeah, fantastic. But I mean, 50 years ago, but with all the sort of the social mores of the late 18th century, basically.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a story in my book about the 1971 Women's World Cup, which is an amazing tale.
Yeah.
But you're right, 50 years later, women were still not tolerated as players in England. Those women who went to play, and girls, you know, 14-year-olds who went to play representing England in the World Cup in Mexico in 1971, when they came back, they were banned by the FA because the FA didn't recognize women's football. Extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary.
I'm not going to get sort of sports political on you on this one, but has it always been a case that the FA, it seems to be sort of bewildered, baffled, and playing catch up as the game and you know, meet the old boss, same as the new boss. But, you know, even now, I mean, Will Carling famously referred to the rugby union football as old farts in blazers or something along those lines. You know, and in Spain, we have a few problems with our own football association. But does it always seem that football tends to move with society, and then the quote unquote people that are supposed to be running the game are sort of bumbling along behind them?
Yeah, they're slow catching up to social change, certainly, and they're slow catching up to the popularity of the game and revising some of their ideas about working men wanting to play, wanting to be paid to play, and working class people wanting to watch. They were slow to catch on and realize the importance of the game in that wider sense. But what I would say in defense of the FA is that one of the reasons why they feared the game becoming global was they feared that football would become too closely connected with politics.
Mm.
And that nations would use football as a way of promoting their own political ideologies, which is exactly what happened in the 1930s. And of course, we still talk about that today. But fascist Italy won two World Cups in the 1930s. And Mussolini made no excuse about connecting the success of the Italian football team to his fascist ideology. And there is a very famous match played in 1935 at White Hart Lane. Again, there's a story about it in my book, in which Germany play England. Now, this is at the heart of the Jewish community in Britain. It's already well known that persecution is going on under Hitler in Germany, but the FA are so determined to keep football and politics separate that they overlook all of this and say, yes, let's play the Germans. We may be able to teach them something and civilize them and change their policies at home. And of course, this becomes a huge success for Hitler, because they come and play the game in England. Hitler sends some supporters over, but tells them to behave. And this ends up being a massive positive impact for the Germans, and convinces some of the English upper classes, who are already, some of them, you know, quite amenable to listen to what was going on in Germany with some approval, it convinced them that the Germans were probably gentlemen as well, that they could play football with us. And so that whole business of the FA being worried about politics and sport really is quite important and astute.
Because on both sides of the spectrum, so because the cult of fitness and body and sport in fascism is well documented. Yeah. Lazio, for example, in Italy still has those Neanderthals supporting the club. You know, again, listeners will know about my fascination with the Reich, but absolutely the whole situation with there is linked into physical fitness and sport. And then, of course, a year later, we've got the Olympics, et cetera, et cetera. And again, but on the flip side, of course, the Soviet Union are forever trying to get a decent football team to go. Iconic they are, but CCP is an iconic sort of retro football shirt. And again, because they know, you know, Marx talks about religion being the opium of the people, but as football takes off in the 50s and 60s, football becomes the opium of the people.
Yeah, indeed. And it is really interesting, you know, that point about the Soviet Union. Think about China. Mm. China has been trying to develop a nation to compete at football on the international stage for 50 years. And they even began a Chinese Super League a few years ago to try and accelerate the trend here. Now, China, there are billions of Chinese, but they can't produce 11 men to play in the Men's World Cup that can compete. Why? Probably because football is not inherent in the culture.
And that is the
part of who we are.
That is the thing, and that is what is happening. Is also talking sports washing, but we look at the Gulf States as well, and Saudi and Dubai, and you can throw as much money as you like, and you can talk about mercenary footballers, but they go out there being promised gadzillions. I mean, look at Neymar is going back now to Santos, and they think this will be great. They get out there, and suddenly they find themselves like Jordan Henderson, get used to seeing the cop, and then they walk out on the fields, and there's 600 people in the stands.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So these things, these issues that the FA were concerned about, you know, for all of their lack of modernity and for all their class prejudice and for all their slowness in responding to the demands that women should play, they did have something to say, importantly, about politics and football. And it's one of the reasons why they were so determined that politics and sport should not mix. They felt wrongly, of course, that sport stood above politics, that sport was a separate realm, and that that once politics began to seep into sport, then the game was lost. Of course, whatever sport you play depends on politics, depends on what kind of society you are. The FA didn't get that. They didn't understand that. And they tried desperately to make sure that football, as they saw it, was not infected by other issues.
Now, I've only got 12 minutes left here, John, so I'm going to cherry pick if it's okay with you, because the other thing about sport, we've so far so heavy, but sport also has the ability to transcend and to build bridges. But in the 1950s, there are a couple of bits and pieces that have always struck me. I'm not a football guy, but we have the Hungarians beating England. Is it 51, 52?
54.
And that sends a seismic shockwave, doesn't it, through English football?
Yeah. Absolutely. We have a couple of things going on in the 50s. We have the fantastic moment of the FA Cup final in 1953 when Stanley Matthews wins his long-awaited medal in the FA Cup, and we've got a new queen, very young and glamorous queen, and football then becomes a kind of focal point for the reorganization, the re-energization of the nation after the war.
Festival of Britain, etc., new Elizabethan age, jet comet, etc.
All of that, you know, Crick and Watson, Everest is being conquered. You know, we're recovering from the terrible traumas of war, and football is right at the heart of that. But you're right, the 54 meeting with the Hungarians is also ideologically very important, because we now find ourselves in the age of the Cold War and communism. And this match becomes a cipher for that debate about whether democratic nations is a better way of organizing things than communism. And so although the FA try and keep sport and politics separate, quietly they're desperate that England beats the Hungarians. And of course the opposite happens. The England are trounced by this brilliant Hungarian team. And that raises all kinds of questions for the British about, are our players fit enough? Are they trained properly? Are we paying them enough? And eventually the maximum wage will be lifted in 1961, because up until then, you have to remember the top level professional footballers were paid little more than skilled workers were. They were employees. They were incredibly badly treated compared to professionals around the world. And those so-called amateurs who played in Hungary, of course, who were supported by the Hungarian state.
And then, of course, if you're thinking about the 60s, and you read the shocking reports in the Daily Mirror and the et cetera about, you know, footballers with long hair, and we tend to look at the 60s now because it's just still within reach as this golden period. But it is, at the time, I mean, a lot of people are saying this is terrible, TV's awful, George Best needs a haircut. You know, the way that they, you know, the Chelsea team up and down the King's Road, what is to become, you know, I mean, Best is called El Beetle. Real Madrid, Franco's team, are running riot in the what used to be, what is now the Champions League. But it does reflect, doesn't it? It does reflect the social mores. And also, you start to get the spectre of hooligans. And I'm not just talking about the UK, but it does rear its head during the late 60s and into the 70s, both in England, the home internationals, of course. Italy's got everywhere tends to have a problem, perhaps apart from Spain, because they're still under a fascist dictatorship.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, the key word for the 60s is youth.
Mm.
It's young people. For the first time, a footballer, George Best, looks like a young person. You know, you look at Stanley Matthews and Tom Finney, players who were still playing when George Best started his career, but they just look like old versions of young men. They don't look any different from their fathers. Suddenly, George Best arrives with youth culture, with a bit more overt consumption, living a life outside of football, becoming a personality and a character. The media feeds all of this, of course. And suddenly football looks like a very different kind of product. And it's much less controlled, as you say, on the terraces and in the stands. Young people get excited. They start watching football separately from others. Youth culture, gang culture begins to infect the game, not only here, but in other parts of the world. So the character of the game really changes, becomes much more glamorous, much more romantic. Much more interesting for young people in many respects, but it brings problems.
But also, with 1970, you know, it's the first World Cup, and I will always see the 1970 World Cup in colour, because it's that. I know that it wasn't broadcast in colour apparently on the BBC, but. What, you know, the brilliant blue of the Azzurri, you know, the yellow and green shorts of yeah. Brazil under that baking Mexican sun. I mean, nothing more romantic. And that, you know, and that at which point sort of football takes off as again, £1 million player and Trevor Francis in the UK. But at the same time, you've got you've still got those political undertones in the UK with National Front, and over in Argentina in 78 with the World Cup, which is heavily influenced by, again, it's that politics coming to the front.
Yeah, all those things the FA wonders about back in the 1920s and 30s, they're right there in the 1970s. The contrast even between the 66 World Cup in England, which, of course, England famously won, and 1970 is stark, I think.
Mm.
There's a great story in the book about how the day after England won the World Cup, Alan Ball and John Connolly, two of the players in the squad, Alan Ball was a great hero of the final, they're travelling home on the M6 and stop at a service station and have egg and chips. Nobody bothers them. Alan Ball has got his World Cup medal in his pocket and he's eating egg and chips in a service station. 4 years later, We're in this extraordinary televisual world of the World Cup in Mexico with that great Brazilian team. Football has taken over the world. It's absolutely taken over the world as a global visual product. And it feels romantic. It feels nothing like the domestic culture we have here. It feels like anything is possible with the game. But it still has those deep-rooted problems that you pointed to. You know, the politics of the game are writ large. That FIFA is desperately trying to manage the situation in relation to the to the fascists in parts of South America, to the communists in parts of Europe, to make the game work for everybody becomes increasingly complex and difficult.
And obviously, in the 80s, we have the terrible tragedies. I mean, we have wonderful moments, Maradona, but again, but football connects with its people, with its supporters in a way that it can't. And you know, Heysel, Hillsborough, you know, the fire. I mean, these things are now burnt into the soul of a city. And it has an impact far greater than 90 minutes of football. And the horror unfolds live on TV. I remember where I was. Every member who was there was. And that is a turning point, and that opens the door. And we've only got 4 minutes, and John, I could be here for the rest of the day with this one. But it opens the door. Something has to be done. And that leads to seater stadiums and the big money coming in.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. Football in England, in Britain, just falls behind in terms of facilities, in terms of safety, in terms of regulation. The government, largely conservative governments, don't care about the game and the people who watch it. Hooliganism becomes the defining feature of English football, particularly. And almost the kind of inevitable outcome is those disasters that you talk about. A huge wake-up call for the game. And we're very fortunate that Lord Justice Taylor, who wrote the report about those disasters, but the end of the 1990s, instead of simply saying, well, this is why it happened and these are the causes and those people ought to be dealt with, he actually says, this game is hugely important. Why is it being run so badly? Why are the facilities so terrible? Why aren't we listening to what supporters want? And so that whole era, the very beginning of the 1990s, we get a complete rethinking of what the game is. Of course, Sky Sports happily, coincidentally, arrive with a bag full of money, and they need football because they're going nowhere in television subscriptions. And top football and subscription TV, they fall into each other's arms and save each other. And the game remarkets itself, promotes itself completely differently. Now, for all of its problems, and it has problems, the Premier League, it saves the game from those terrible situations we were in the 1980s.
Yeah, and also, just quickly, I'm going to say this in 2 minutes, but Italia 90, there's Lynam, football becomes sexy, women go to the football grounds, family goes to the football ground, and then there's 96, and, you know, it's Britpop, and, you know, I was there, and the whole, in a way that hasn't been seen for a very long time, in England especially, nation gets behind, everybody's heroes, and we've seen that again, leaping through to three decades in about 2 minutes, we see it again with Southgate and the recent, and the women's football too, John.
Yeah, well, you know, of course, Nick Hornby is crucial in 1992. Middle-class people like football too. And you're right, the recent reincarnation of the England national team is a multiracial, modern version of England promoted by Gareth Southgate and others. The amazing success of the women's team, despite all the barriers that have been placed in front of them, they become champions and World Cup finalists. Extraordinary positive story. For all the problems the game has, we're in a much better place than we were 20 or 30 years ago.
John, as you can probably tell, we could talk about this until Monday lunchtime, but I've only got a minute and 32 seconds left to go. The book is called Football in Wind and Rain. Great picture of Derby County, by the way. My co-presenter is a big Rams fan. Football in Wind and Rain, The Making of the British Game. Where can people find you online, John?
Well, I'm on X. And I'm on Instagram, so you can pick me up there. You can email me, jxw@le.ac.uk. I would love to hear from people, particularly if they've managed to get hold of a copy of the book and read some of it. I'm around and available and look forward to a conversation.
What are you on Instagram as by the way?
Because, no idea.
Okay, fine. Just key in John Williams, and if it's a guy looking something
You'll
like
find
a,
me. They'll find me.
You, and also, and I advise you to do this, you can also order it via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Football in Wind and Rain, The Making of the British Game. It is by John Williams. You can order it on our own virtual bookstore. John, as you can probably tell, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
And to me.